KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right, like peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
Shame is a movie about a sex addict, and it's gotten the dreaded NC-17 rating. So who put up the money for it, and who has the nerve to distribute it? Plus, when you go to the movies, do you think you're getting your money's worth? We talked to the head of the National Association of Theater Owners. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
I'm joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, the awards races are getting underway, and we don't exactly have the kind of thing we had last year where it seemed very clear that it was King's Speech versus Social Network with an edge to King's Speech. But I'm hearing, I think, that you may have a favorite.
Well, I think The Town has a favorite. I think The Artist, which is a silent black and white film that is being released by that master Oscar manipulator, Harvey Weinstein, has got a lot of momentum. I mean, it's a silent film that pays homage to the creation of cinema, so I think it will resonate with the Academy members. You can make the same argument for Hugo, Martin Scorsese's film, but I think it's an exceptional film that's gotten great reviews, and it's distinct. It's unlike anything you've seen this year. So while a lot of people, including myself, love The Descendants, The Artist feels like it's this movie that is really about to take off.
And I will just point out to our listeners that if you missed it, we interviewed the director and producer of The Artist a couple of weeks ago. You can find it on our webpage, kcrw.com/thebusiness, and it's worth a listen. I can't think of an executive in this business, by the way, that could be compared with Harvey Weinstein. I mean, you can't imagine Steve Gilula from Fox Searchlight pulling the kind of stuff. I mean, Harvey Weinstein is on a publicity tour, not just for this movie, The Artist, because he also has My Week with Marilyn, starring Michelle Williams, and some other potential contenders. But seems to me like he's banking pretty heavily on The Artist. And John, I think you were at this Academy premiere where he pulled one of his classic stunts.
Yes, he brought out two of Charlie Chaplin's granddaughters. And let me just tell you, you would not think they look what they look like, which is very attractive, and they were scantily clad. And then they were scantily clad? They were indeed.
Not wearing then, like black hats with little mustaches. Okay,
they
go
were
on.
Not. They were not. And then Harvey, you know, made some introductory remarks and was working the room. I mean, it felt like it was, you know, the old Harvey. He was back in his element, like it was Shakespeare in Love or The English Patient. It felt like he knew he had something on his hands and he was going to work it very hard.
So with the fate of the awards movies, you know, still in a state of flux, despite the apparent embrace of The Artist, you know, it's still early. Things can change in this business and have. But the larger fate of the industry is a subject right now of very hot debate in quite a different arena in Washington, where there is legislation that is being introduced and about to be debated in the House, which is intended to be an anti-piracy measure to prevent the untold losses that the studios suffer and others because of pirated, stolen, you know, downloads of movies and TV shows. But this is very, very controversial. It sort of pits the Hollywood studios against Silicon Valley, and it's being framed by those who oppose the bill as an attack on internet freedom.
I mean, there's no question that there's a tremendous amount of piracy that's going on, and some surveys have shown that 70% of college students have bootleg music or videos. But this, to a lot of critics of free speech, goes a little bit too far in that it eliminates a provision that is common in U.S. websites now, which is a Safe Harbor Act. So if you are the creator of content and you find a YouTube video that violates your copyright, you can call up YouTube and they can take it down. These bills go much further and they prohibit the owners of these websites from collecting money from people if they have infringing material on their site. So you don't really get that safe harbor component. And it really places a very high burden on these websites to police their own content themselves, which is very different from how the law stands now.
Well, so that is something that Hollywood has definitely got a major stake in and has, as I said, staked out the pro position. And it will be interesting to see whether the Silicon Valley interests will be able to take this bill down. I know Taylor Hackford, the head of the Directors Guild of America, feels that this is no less significant than the fate of the industry. Piracy is just siphoning off money that the industry feels it cannot afford to lose.
No, in many ways, the debate is very much like the Patriot Act now. It's, you know, there is obviously an identifiable problem. There's a need, but does it go too far? And it's going to be a very lively and interesting debate.
Meanwhile, in the realm of trying to hold on to your money, a lawsuit has been filed against Paramount by a group of investors called Melrose Investors. And no high-profile names, I guess, associated with this group, but definitely a big wad of money. They invested $375 million in 29 Paramount films since 2006. And they are saying that they have not seen one penny.
I think what's distinct about this lawsuit, because there's often lawsuits about blockbusters not making any money and the vagaries of Hollywood accounting, these are not mom-and-pop investors. These are probably banks, hedge funds, high-net-worth people who are investing in Melrose. And the movies that they invested in have grossed $7 billion worldwide. They include the Transformers movies, Mission Impossible 3, Blades of Glory, movies that were incredibly successful. So I think what's going to happen if this is not settled is you could find some very interesting discovery where Paramount is forced to produce documents that become part of the public file about how they accounted for these movies and how much overhead they spend, how much they pay themselves for distribution and marketing fees. And I think the gist of the complaint is that Paramount inflated its expenses and yielded a accounting formula that left these investors with no money.
Yeah, well, you and I would hope as journalists that we get exactly that, a big splashy trial with access to all sorts of documents that we never get to see. Based on the statement that Paramount has released, which expresses disappointment that these sophisticated investors would choose to file a lawsuit filled with hyperbole, et cetera, that's the language of the Paramount statement, they say they will vigorously defend the lawsuit. But they say also that the differences between the parties' positions are relatively modest in amount, and we are confident that they can be resolved in the ordinary course, which sounds like they want to settle. I can't imagine how modest. You know, to me, millions.
Yeah, a couple $100 million, yeah. Right?
That's not
modest to them.
But, you know, hey, that's Hollywood. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Let us know what industry stories you're following on our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business. There's one thing Hollywood studios want to avoid, it's the NC-17 rating. No one under 17 admitted. This rating is not good for business. By far the biggest grossing NC-17 movie of all time was Showgirls in 1995, and it barely cleared $20 million in grosses. Not good considering that that was less than half its budget. Not so long ago, theater complexes wouldn't play NC-17 movies, and newspapers didn't want to run ads for them. And obviously an NC-17 film can draw only a narrow segment of the audience. So just about every studio in the business insists on having an R rating. If a filmmaker flirts with an NC-17, a movie is usually cut to get to that R. But this year, Fox Searchlight is going boldly where other studios don't go, with Shame, which just opened in limited release. Co-written and directed by British filmmaker and visual artist Steve McQueen, Shame stars Michael Fassbender as an internet sex addict in New York. The film is graphic with full frontal nudity and explicit sex scenes. In this brief clip, Fassbender's character is trying to go on a normal date.
Okay, well, this is me.
This is you?
This is me. Thank you very much, Brandon.
Thank you very much, Marianne. We should do this again.
Right.
When Shame screened at the Telluride Film Festival in August, John Horn declared on this show that it's not NC-17, but NC-40. Given that, we wondered how the film was financed and then sold. We called up London-based Torsten Schumacher and Claire Taylor of Hanway Films, the British sales company that handled the movie. They said Shame pulled together its financing from European distributors based on the strength of the script and the pedigree of filmmaker McQueen, who had established himself with his previous feature, Hunger, also starring Michael Fassbender. But Schumacher acknowledged it was clear from the start Shame presented special challenges.
It's a very explicit screenplay as well. You know, I remember I was reading it in London on the tube, on the underground. I was constantly looking over my shoulder, worrying that someone would be actually be reading what I was reading over my shoulder. I was blushing. But distributors, you know, these distributors, they really trusted his ability, and I think they weren't disappointed, especially the people who came in very early, you know.
And Shame is produced by Ian Canning and Emile Sherman, who produced The King's Speech. So we knew the film was sufficiently packed with very reliable people and talent to make one feel extremely confident that despite the subject matter, it was not going to be as challenging as you might think.
The next logical question, how did Shame go over when those foreign distributors who had pre-bought the film finally saw it for the first time?
All of the distributors in Europe who had already bought it were ecstatic. I mean, I got a text from the Belgian distributor immediately after screening saying, I am speechless and shaken, this film will change history.
It's quite gratifying because these distributors, you know, they sometimes bet the house and they pre-buy these films for $1 million or more, you know, in these foreign territories. And they kind of have an idea what they're buying, but not really, you know. And let's face it, it could go either way. So when they come to Toronto or Venice and they're sitting down and they're screening and the lights go off, they're quite nervous.
Hanwha Films introduced Shame to the broader movie world late last summer with presentations at the Venice Film Festival, as well as Telluride and Toronto. The point was to target the best possible buyer to distribute the film theatrically in the U.S. and other unsold territories. Schumacher says the attack was planned with strategic precision.
We had like spreadsheets of all the U.S. distributors and what campaigns they had and who were the front runners for the film and who had which NC-17 films before. And so we had a pretty clear idea who to target. And the conditions were laid out clearly right in advance, way before the screening.
In selling Shame, Schumacher and Taylor had specific conditions for those distributors looking to buy the film. They had to agree to release the movie in this calendar year in order to take advantage of the momentum coming out of the fall film festivals and to qualify for awards consideration. And, most importantly, they couldn't edit the film. What they saw was what they got.
Yes, I think if when you screen the film, I think you would understand that it would be very, very hard to cut a single frame of the film because of the way that it's structured and how a couple of the key scenes, which obviously are what have given it the NC-17 rating, they are cut in such a way you wouldn't want to cut any of it. And we completely respect that. So it was never even discussed as being a problem. It was just discussed as a reality, and that's the way it was, and that's the way it always was.
Despite these restrictions, Hanwha had multiple bidders for the U.S. rights.
Yes, we did. And but I guess, you know, people were blown away by what they saw on screen. It's a very powerful example of contemporary filmmaking, you know.
It is like a physical experience. When you watch it, a couple of people have commented how, I think one person commented that they actually had their toes curled throughout the film. And I feel that you inhale at the beginning of the film and that you exhale at the end.
I asked how Fox Searchlight ended up winning the right to distribute Shame.
Because they reacted to it in such an incredibly personal way. They were actually overwhelmed by the film. And, you know, you can always tell when someone is pretending whether they like something or not. And this was so genuine. And they made such tremendous efforts to acquire the film that there was no question of there being any anxiety.
And they had the most fleshed out plan for this year, which really was well received by the filmmakers and the financiers who in the end decide.
Torsten Schumacher is managing director and Claire Taylor is sales manager for Hanwha Films, an international film sales company. They joined us by phone from London. If you're just joining us, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Hollywood studios and theater owners have long had their quarrels, but in the past couple of years, theater owners have begun to feel that they may face an existential threat. the studios have been looking for ways to release movies through video on demand, ever closer to their release in theaters. In April of this year, four major studios, Fox, Universal, Warner Brothers, and Sony, began releasing certain movies on demand through DirecTV about 8 weeks after they opened. That's a lot less than the usual 4 months. For $30, you could watch such films as Sony's Adam Sandler, Jennifer Aniston comedy, Just Go With It, or Universal's The Adjustment Bureau with Matt Damon, in the comfort of your home. Filmmakers like James Cameron, Kathryn Bigelow, and Todd Phillips don't like this plan. They've protested that giving customers access to movies on TV screens earlier and earlier could kill the theatrical experience and the value of movies in general. The controversy was ignited again a couple of months ago when Universal flirted with an experimental plan to release the Ben Stiller, Eddie Murphy comedy, Tower Heist, on demand with its parent company Comcast for $60 just weeks after its theatrical release. That test was scrapped, but given the clear agenda of the studios, theater owners are not resting easy. Movie fans aren't that happy either. They just want to see good movies at affordable prices, and too often, they say, they pay too much to step on gum and listen to annoying chatter in the audience. So we had a lot to talk about when we sat down with John Fithian, head of the Washington, D.C.-based National Association of Theater Owners. I asked him if he was here in L.A. to go mano a mano with the Hollywood studios.
The question is still open. I hope that we've progressed beyond wrestling. The issue of when a movie gets released to the cinema is an issue of primary concern for us because we believe that exclusive period drives the cinema exposure and industry and profitability. And it's an issue for them because we don't want the studios to homogenize their titles to make everything look like a television movie. We think something released in the cinema is special, and therefore that release period shows the consumer that it's special and gets them out of their house and out to the cinema to experience a shared movie. And we think that when a movie makes it big in the cinema, then drives the ancillary markets.
You're saying that if the movie comes out and it's a big hit, the chances that people will actually buy a DVD or pay to rent it through digital streaming, whatever, increase.
Absolutely.
And, right.
Absolutely.
So this is why it is, in your view, in their interest for them to preserve the theatrical window. At least how many days?
Well, that's to be determined. We're not quite sure yet what the right release model is. We know that the DVD sales have decreased substantially for the studios, and they need to replace those revenues. It helps our cinema operators if they do replace those revenues because we need them to do well so they can make more movies for us in the future. The question is how they can replace those revenues.
Without destroying their business,
absolutely.
In your view.
Mm-hmm. Video on demand is a new, relatively new, way of releasing movies to the home. There's a lot of hope that that digital distribution stream can replace the declining DVD sales. And the question is how the studios can drive VOD sales without damaging cinema sales.
Is there any number in your mind at this point? I mean, the studios keep saying movies are played out in 4 weeks.
Certainly, they're looking at something less than the 4 months that's been the average release on DVDs. And our members, I think, spoke out pretty loudly on Tower Heist and said it's going to be a whole lot more than what was being proposed in that model. Where this settles out will depend on several things. It'll depend on the price point. It'll depend on the type of the movie. Some movies last much longer in cinemas than others. You know, you referenced a statement that most movies play out in 4 weeks. Some do. Some don't. And we're very concerned, as are the independent filmmakers that I talk to around town, that if we shorten the window dramatically, we're going to eclipse that possibility for the small films to grow and become bigger films. So there's a lot at stake in how the movies are released.
Coming up after a short break, will theater owners do anything to make the movie-going experience more enjoyable? And what about those 3D ticket prices? You're listening to The Business from KCRW and KCRW.com.
Hi, this is Darby Maloney, producer of The Business. Catch up with The Business and lots of film and television news on our Facebook page. Search for KCRW's The Business and click like.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with John Fithian, head of the National Association of Theater Owners, about the state of movie theaters. I told Fithian that whenever we talk on the air about challenges facing theater owners, we invite an onslaught of complaints from listeners who are more concerned about the challenges they face when they go to the movies. I mean, we had almost like a very eloquent 10-paragraph essay, which I sent to an executive at one of the studios from some listener who was just saying, the theater experience is bad and it's awful. And why should I pay all this money when it's not a good experience? People are talking on their cell phones. I'm forced to see ads. There's junk in the theaters, you know. And that is huge, right? That is a huge public perception that you guys are facing right now.
Well, part of what we've done well is improve the cinema experience. Part of what we have done poorly is message that improved experience. I mean, look what's happened in the last few years in the cinema business. We are spending $3 billion converting from film to digital technologies that provide a pristine visual image, better sound, 3D exhibition, alternative content, a much, much, much better experience for the consumer. We built stadium seating. We have multiple showtimes. Many of our members are now combining the cinematic experience with luxury dining or alcohol service. There's a lot going on to improve the way that people can watch movies in cinemas. The problem is we really haven't messaged that very well. And I think that's our next task. And frankly, at our last board meeting where all of our top members gathered in Washington, D.C. a couple of months ago, that was one of our decisions, was we need to reach out more to the consumer to describe what's going on in the cinema business and the amenities that we're adding to the experience to make it really the best place possible to see a movie. And the other thing I would say about that listener's comments is that the experience is very different in different locations. I would ask them to shop around. It's a free market, and try different cinemas and see what some of our aggressive entrepreneurs are doing right now, because there are some beautiful cinemas being constructed with beautiful amenities and just top line visual images. And we think, you know, in the main, we're offering a really good experience now. We want to keep improving so that all of them are like that. That's part of what the big digital transition is about.
You know, here in Los Angeles, if you go to the Landmark Theater in Westside Pavilion, you buy your ticket, you pick your seat, and it just creates a much different experience because you don't feel that you are scrambling and hoping that there's maybe a seat that you can find and, you know, you won't be together with your party, whatever. Why doesn't everybody do that?
Well, again, it's all about consumer choice and offering different styles of the cinema experience to different consumers is the best way to maximize the experience. And so there are many markets in which the so-called luxury cinema works. By luxury cinema, we can mean assigned seatings, we can mean better seats, we can mean valet service, babysitting service, you know, food beyond the typical concessions, real meals, alcohol service, you name it. More often than not, that kind of luxury experience comes at a higher price tag. So we also have to cater to the more price-conscious consumer by having a more traditional cinema experience at a more traditional price.
Is the cost so different if I can pick my seat?
Everything has a cost to it. Picking your seat involves usher time. It involves labor costs. You know, improving the food service involves servers and kitchen and real estate. So there are always costs involved in adding amenities to the service, and it's just a matter of finding a balance on what consumers and what locations are willing to pay for those amenities and where they don't.
I would imagine for your constituents, there is a certain feeling like, you know, the studios came along and said, we really have to do 3D, and we kind of want you to pay to upgrade your theaters and upgrade your everything to make this work. And then there, it just feels like to you, I suppose, to your people, that there's a lot of attempt on the studios to just keep pushing you guys to pay more and more and more yourselves, notwithstanding how mad people are about, you know, the price of popcorn.
Well, ironically, or maybe surprisingly is a better word, the studio community and the cinema community worked very closely together to make the digital cinema 3D transition happen.
Eventually.
But it took a while.
Yes.
No doubt about it. I mean, George Lucas wanted to get moving really early a long time ago, before we had technical standards, before we had a business model, and I admire George's vision, but we weren't quite ready yet. Well, now everything's come together. We have technical standards, we have high quality equipment, we have business models where there's a shared cost between the studios and the cinema owners. And so we're rolling. We're 60% digitized in the United States. We'll be done in a couple of years. By the end of 2013, there won't be any film in cinemas anymore in this country. So a rather historic transition has taken place through cooperation of both the studios and the cinema owners. And I think that's something that's exciting.
How important will 3D be to theater owners?
3D will not be as important as everyone thought a year ago. 3D will be much more important than everyone thinks right now. I'm always amazed at the roller coaster effect in reporting on our business. I guess everybody thinks the movies and theaters are sexy, and so everyone reports on it. But a year ago, if you read any of the trade papers, any of the common press, you would have thought that 3D was, you know, the savior of the exhibition industry and the best thing that ever happened to us. If you've read anything in the trade press in the last, you know, few months or up to a year, well, 3D is dying and it's never going to survive. The truth is somewhere in the middle. 3D is a good value enhancer for the right kind of movies for the right kind of audiences. 3D cannot take a bad movie and make a bad movie good. So we're learning. We're kind of at the toddler stage of this 3D technology right now. We, the cinema owners, are learning how to keep the technology right and how to keep the light sources up and how to keep the glasses fresh. At the same time, the studios are learning how to assign 3D to movies where it really enhances the value of the movie and isn't just a gimmick to try and make, you know, a bad movie mediocre.
Well, now studios deserve some blame for doing bad 3D conversions. We've heard Jim Cameron talk about how vile and reprehensible that is, and we've seen some vile and reprehensible examples of it. But what about the theater's role in setting these prices that people feel it's just not justified to pay that premium? I have to admit, as a mom, I had sticker shock when my kid went to a 3D movie and came back. You know, I had very little change from my $20 bill.
My reaction to the pricing issue is that we need to offer choices to our consumers. I mean, if you think about it, what we're growing into now in the cinema business is you can have a 2D experience at one price point. You can have a 3D experience at another price point. You can have a big screen or IMAX experience at a third price point. If you don't like those normal offerings, there are matinees and discounts and other ways you can see a movie. You can wait and watch it in a discount house
But people have gotten mad. I mean, this is like a thing now.
No one got mad about the pricing on Avatar. Okay?
But there's only one Avatar.
Well, you know, very few people got mad about the pricing on Alice in Wonderland. And you go through the movies and there are some tremendous successes where the movie worked with the 3D in a way it could have never worked without it. A good movie made brilliant by 3D.
Well, is there a world where the cinema owner should say, you know, this movie is not Alice in Wonderland and not Avatar, and therefore we're not going to overreach here because we are part of the problem of killing that goose?
The way that we in the cinema industry have to do that is in private dialogue with the studios to say, you know, please don't give us a sow with 3D as its lipstick to try and make it look good. And we're doing that privately, just as they are saying to us, please give our movies the best 3D experience they can have in the cinema. But the price point differential, if the movie is good and the experience is good, is well worth it. And we've had—
I hear you. Just those are huge ifs.
Of course. Well, we've had owners experiment with lowering price points dramatically on 3D in some locations, and it doesn't help. It's frankly the case that if the movie is perceived as being a value in 3D, they will go in 3D. If the movie is not perceived as being a value in 3D, they won't. And so the price differential stands for increased quality, and we just have to keep zeroing in on making sure the quality is better.
John Fithian is head of the National Association of Theater Owners. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Kim. My pleasure.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to us on demand with our KCRW smartphone apps, and you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.